Welcome to Season 3, Episode 8 of Swift Over Coffee. I'm Paul Hudson.
And I'm Michaela Caron.
In this episode, we discuss the state of play of using AI for building apps.
I think at the moment we are not currently out of a job because people cannot accurately describe what they want.
We share your views on how you approach debugging.
Good luck with that, ChatGPT. Get bisect. Plus, nope, does not exist. La 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 la, I can't hear you. So Michaela, for me, my brain is all over the place right now. It's been a really, really busy week. I've announced Unwrapped Live 2024, focusing on VisionOS. I've just been to another VisionOS lab in London, although I can't say much about it. There's just all sorts of VisionOS stuff in my head flying around. So my brain's all over the place. How are you doing?
Not too bad. I went to the VisionOS labs a couple months ago, so it has stopped flying around for me. And I was like, oh yeah, that was a thing. And that's all I can say.
I know. They make you sign NDA, folks. You can say nothing about it that isn't already, you know, public, i.e. in the APIs on develop.apple.com stuff. But, you know, can't mention a device, can't mention anything physically you've written in code. It's very, very locked down.
Yeah, but I think it is cool. We do get, Apple's been sending, I think, about monthly newsletters now. So like the App Store Awards just happened. So congrats to everybody who won or finalists for that. And like the little news snippets of things they send like every month or so, which I think has been pretty cool.
Yeah, they're certainly trying. I like the approach. I'm not sure how much success it's having. Certainly, you know, in Feedback Assistant, they have all the beta notes, release notes for various betas.
Mm-hmm.
I never actually read those ever. I want to go away, mark as unread or unsubscribe me. I don't really care too much, quite frankly. Maybe they're having better luck with this article approach. I'm not sure. But I definitely saw, was it Clemens Strasser was featured in there with his ancient board games?
Yes, thing, I believe. Right? I believe so.
I love that. It's nice just picking out someone from the community saying, hey, this person's doing great work, and then highlighting them and basically cheering them on. It's great.
Yes. How do we apply for that? I want to know.
Apply for it. Please feature me. I think step one is build a great app.
Oh.
And then make sure Apple know about it. And then you should be halfway there, right?
So let's talk about some news. One of the things that did come through that newsletter too was that we now have 25 hours of compute time for Xcode Cloud for free, included with our Apple developer subscription that we get or that we pay for.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a freebie. I guess, I don't know. Is it enough for a serious company to use Xcode Cloud? No, it's not. You'll burn through that in no time at all, particularly with Swift and Swift UI. Thinking a bit on the slower side to compile, but it's enough to get you hooked, I think. And certainly for small-ish developers, small to very small developers, 25 hours should be enough. But it gets you on the hook, hopefully, and gets you paying more. But I'm still not quite sure what the bigger play is. Like, Apple aren't going to make money being an Xcode Cloud company, presumably, are they? Is that really a meaningful revenue source for them?
Probably not. It might just be enough that it just pulls you into the ecosystem more because you can use Xcode Cloud and not have to set up any kind of scripting language and like download even more things to your computer. It just is all integrated in Xcode.
Yeah. So if Apple are like, okay, the current state of play, I'm not going to mention brands, but companies out there doing this for Apple people, if their thing Apple think sucks, this is not good enough, it's actually getting our developers down, then replacing it with something better is a good idea. But then don't put such a small cap on it. Make it like 200 hours. I don't know. It just seems like if it made 1% of 1% of 1% of what iOS makes, iPhone makes, I'd be amazed. I suspect it's making much, much less than that, quite frankly. And I don't know that ever will make more than that. I'm not sure. So I'm willing to be proven wrong. Maybe it's going to grow into a huge, big thing for Apple. And I guess they don't want to say no to money. And also, to be fair, they're probably using it themselves, right? So they're like, well, we've made this great Xcode Cloud thing for our internal tools. Let's at least monetize it and recoup the cost of that. That makes sense. But I'm just struggling to see it make a big impact.
I think it'll be just super nice. The fact that it is, quote unquote, free with your $99 subscription per year, it's nice for beginners to probably start dabbling in CI/CD, which is continuous improvement, continuous delivery or deployment. That'll kind of just get you started in some place. And then you can kind of use other tools from there once you've either hit limits on Xcode Cloud and you don't want to pay, or you've hit limits on Xcode Cloud and just the functionality that it has, because it is still pretty new too. It was only just like released what, a year ago?
Yeah, I remember. Was it Rhonda from the Xcode team introduced it in State of the Union? And I was like, oh, it's actually quite impressive. And they had done great work. And it is obviously very tightly integrated into the Xcode environment, which is a big, big power play for it. I don't know. I'm not sure how many beginners even care about continuous integration in the first place. We're going to find out. I'm willing to be surprised. And I think the thing is, we pay, what, $99 a year for access to the program. And in theory, make your money back by selling a few apps pretty quickly. But the biggest thing you get for your money is access to the DTS system, the developer tech support engineers, the handful of like a team engineers inside Apple who answer questions from around the world. And you get to ask them a question, hard one or two questions every year to you know, my code's broken, how do I fix this? And they almost never get used. Like, everyone gets these DTS tickets every single year with their Apple account, and almost no one uses them. And that's why Apple can get by with a fairly small team there, because most folks aren't looking at these things. We sort of hoard them thinking, oh, there'll be a big problem next year. Big problem next year. Better set up for the big problem next year and never actually use a thing. I don't. I'm relentlessly cheeky.
I haven't used one.
Oh, never. Oh, it's so much fun. And I know them too. I know the poor people have to answer my questions. I've sent them really stuff. I've just like stuff like, my AI here isn't very good. Can you make it better? They've written back with better code. I say, oh, you've sold it here, here, and here. It's much better. Thank you so much. They're really good. So, and they know who they are. I can't mention the names because I've met them in person, but they're lovely people and they do want more work. So,
send your questions, they want more work. Another thing that was announced recently too is iOS 17.2 has shipped, and this finally includes the journal app that was featured in the keynote, was it? Or was it the State of the Union?
Must be the keynote, you think, wouldn't you?
I can't remember which one, but it was announced in one of those two videos that we will get the journal app, and now it is finally out for regular people who don't run betas. And that comes with the journal suggestions API too.
It does, and it's interesting that the journaling sessions API does not do what I expected. Like, I was thinking it'd be along the lines of like, oh, I make an app about running or about cross-stitching or about, I know, snowboarding. I can submit to the journaling system my activities. Like, oh, yeah, tell them about this great cross-stitching they've just made, whatever it is, right? No, it's the other way around. It can recommend things to your app. Like, oh, I hadn't.
Oh, interesting.
What? Does that make sense?
I haven't even looked at it, really. And I haven't used it either. So that's interesting and not what I would expect either, too.
Yeah. So basically, it's a picker. Like, you know how you have the photos picker right now?
Yeah.
You should put a photo in the library. It shows events from their actual life, right? And they can just pick one and it'll say, oh, hey, and pass you that thing they've selected back to your app. You can think about using that somehow in your app. And I don't know. It's odd. Maybe I'm just missing out on the idea, perhaps. I had really thought it'd be the other way around. I'd recommend, like, I've got a flower app. I can recommend the flowers I've picked recently, for example, to journaling generally. Nope, it's the other way around. And so, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing how that one pans out.
That's interesting. And yeah, I'd be interested to see what people do with it. Or if it's just one of the APIs that, like, ends up being announced, but then like nobody uses it and like everybody kind of forgets about it.
Maybe. I wonder whether it's a great way to encourage other folks to build journaling apps, to receive suggestions from there, or, you know, I really don't know. I think it's one of those things that I'm just not understanding, and I'll see folks use it and go, oh, that's obvious now. They've seen the thing I hadn't seen. So I'm anticipating the community building some great things and then surprising me with it, which is how it normally works.
And that's the thing. It's, we can do anything or everything that we can try to figure out. And it's cool seeing what possibilities everybody can make too, because that really is what makes apps useful for people, is when we do something and then like it just reveals something that you're like, wow, that's amazing. Why didn't we think of that sooner?
On to this episode's theme. And this time we're talking about the state of using AI for building apps. And obviously there are stacks of AI out there, but let's face it, at this point, really it kind of comes down to ChatGPT and GitHub Copilot. I think Google has announced their new thing, Calypso or Callisto or some...
Was it Gemini?
Greekish sort of that one? Mythology name. Gemini, maybe Gemini, yeah, something like that. Some definitely better than ChatGPT that they've definitely announced, and definitely didn't fake the video, apparently. Did fake the video. And And so there are a bunch of ways of building apps with AI. And I think last year in December-ish when ChatGPT 4, was it December about then, it landed. And everyone's like, that's it. It's over now. It's so good. We're going to be out of our jobs in a year. And we're a year on and nothing's really changed. Like, you know, okay, fine. Some folks are using it to teach at school and similar stuff. But like nothing dramatic has changed, that's for sure. And it's interesting that the predictions aren't really panning out. It's like AI is very clever. You can make pictures of squirrels in astronaut suits and stuff. But it hasn't really, really, truly changed the landscape for developers just yet. What do you think, Michaela?
I think at this point, it's one of those things for me where it's good at generating ideas for things, like generating your keywords for your app, like plug in what, here's my app store description, or I need an app store description, like that kind of stuff. I think it's really good at. But for me so far, I have had trouble with actually using ChatGPT or Microsoft's GitHub Copilot for actually generating code that I would use in my actual application. It just, I don't know if I'm doing the prompt wrong or whatever, but like it has not been working for me. I'll ask it a question and it'll just give me back a wrong answer. And then when I tell it it's wrong, it gives me a different answer. And I tell it that answer is still wrong, it'll give me the first answer again.
Yeah, it's, you think GitHub, firstly, of all the possible options, GitHub has the biggest chance of succeeding. Just simply the amount of code they're sitting on, right? Sitting on lots and lots of code. And they've built something designed for code. Whereas ChatGPT is a regular sort of large language model that just happens to be quite good at coding. And so GitHub should have the best chance. And even then, it's not particularly great. But ultimately, even if it was quite good at building apps, let's say it's like a regular junior app developer quality, sit down, it'll figure things out with Stack Overflow and GitHub and, I don't know, ChatGPT. Eventually you get an answer out that's kind of okay. You can ship it. Would you ship it? I mean, would you want to ship it, given that you have to maintain that code in the future for the next year and then the year after, the year after, year after? Would you feel enough confidence in your skill that if it goes wrong in the future, you can say, hey, ChatGPT, this code you gave me last year isn't working anymore. Can we look at it again?
I wonder, that's something I'm not sure about, is I know ChatGPT is trained off of specific models that go up to a certain date. Mm-hmm. Is GitHub Copilot the same way? Or do they have like, I just made my Hacktoberfest project, is some of that code being used to train GitHub's Copilot model? So it's using the most up-to-date observable macro kind of stuff. Is that also being fed into the model? That would be my question, because...
Maybe, yeah. And annoyingly, there's no way for us to block that. You know, that we cannot put a license on our GitHub code saying, hey, MIT license, but do not use this for machine learning training. Because they've got access to all your code. They can do what they like with it, quite frankly.
Ooh, I didn't realize that.
And there's no way of opting out of it. Yeah, so if you have your own site, if you run your own site, you can say, you know, ChatGPT, do not index my site. Do not slurp up my content for training purposes. Do not steal my stuff, basically. But you can't do it with GitHub. GitHub will basically take your stuff regardless of what you say to them, because they can. And it's on their servers. They can do what they like, quite frankly.
Ooh.
So is it training constantly? I'm not sure. But it's a problem, of course, because, you know, SwiftUI changes very quickly, mm-hmm. as does the observation framework or Swift data or whatever. It's always evolving. And so being 6 months out of date, a year out of date, is actually quite a long way in the iOS world.
Yeah, that's especially because you're about to do your Unwrap Live, which has all the VisionOS stuff, but like ChatGPT, GitHub Copilot. I'm guessing both of them don't know anything about VisionOS or that it even exists yet, just based on how everything is trained. So we have to rely on people like you and all the other content creators on, like, in Apple's docs on figuring out how do we develop for Vision Pro.
It has been, let's say, interesting preparing the material for Unwrap Live, because it's basically a whole day of workshops about VisionOS. Apple's documentation is particularly challenging, and I get it, they're moving quickly, they're moving fast and breaking things, whatever, but the dub videos are basically all out of date now. It's frustrating that code's wrong, and they don't re-record it, they don't write documentation for it, and so It's been a challenge, but let's park that. This is about AI right now. Let's stick to that AI thing for now. What I found AI is excellent at is all the tedious work I don't want to do. For example, when I say, generate me some sample JSON I can use to illustrate data in my app or whatever, it makes sample data very, very effectively and efficiently. I know there are sites out there to generate sample users or whatever, but ChatGPT does it very quickly and it's fairly customizable as well. And so that I find all the donkey work I don't want to do, as you said, all the metadata like App Store Connect stuff, it can do that very well. Coding stuff I'm less sure about. There needs to be a solution for it somewhere on the web for it to figure it out. And that could be in Python or Haskell or Rust or something like that. If it's already solved somewhere in a way ChatGPT understands, it can have a go at solving it in Swift and it might be correct. But it's just, I think it misses the point. That's my ultimate worry is that if Apple shipped Xcode Copilot, whatever they call it, Xcode coding assistant, whatever, I'd struggle to see them doing that because I don't think code is the problem. We have enough code right now. Apple wants beautiful apps. They want original apps. And that's not about the coding. It's about having something that genuinely has some great content or a great angle or a great design. And AI does none of those things. AI doesn't do any of that. All I really want to do is have my code, a method I'm working on, put a comment before it saying, you know, this calculates the, I don't know, Manhattan distance from A to B, something like that, right? And have Xcode say, okay, that's what you think it does. I've read your code through you. Here are some things to take into account. You could change this code here to be faster, this code here to fix a leak maybe, this code here, you've missed a condition, whatever. So rather than telling you the code to write, read through my code and diagnose it and say, oh, here's ways to improve it to run faster or less RAM or whatever. That I would appreciate because that way it's following my vision for the app, following my goal as a human creator, designer for the app, and my algorithms there, I know, understand it. It can help prod me towards a better solution. That would be a great Apple angle if they could do it. We'll see.
Dogs. Aw.
Yeah, one of them got a treat. They both. You had two already. Not you. No, you had two already. No, absolutely not. They don't understand. They've got no idea. Like, they had it 5 minutes ago. Never happened.
I know GitHub Copilot can do that. What you're talking about, it can have context around the code that you are writing. So, like, I've used GitHub Copilot inside of VS Code as opposed to, like, I mean, you can't use it. You can somewhat use it in Xcode. I've seen a plugin that does it, but of course, because Microsoft develops Visual Studio Code as well, of course it's integrated, but it can do that and have context around what your code is and what it does. That is possible, but yeah, it's the fact that you still have to go back and forth between Xcode and VS Code or anything else really until Apple decides to put some kind of AI feature inside of Xcode.
Right, and that's the reason to do it. I think, is that people really want this integration and they can't do it currently. So they're kind of bouncing around outside Xcode, which Apple doesn't want to get to. They want to stick in their tools, right? I understand that. But I'd want to see a good solution. If Apple just started churning out half-baked documentation by using ChatGPT, cool, anyone can do that. That's not helpful. It's not, you know, so in the age of ChatGPT 4, it's been like a year since it came out, long as the 3.5, my traffic has barely moved. People still come to the site because they know my solutions are easy to find. They're complete. They're tested. They're up to date. All these nice things. That's what they care about my code. And I don't want Apple to fall into this trap of just churning stuff out. I can't imagine them doing that. It's not an Apple-y thing to do. And so I suspect if they do go down AI somehow in Xcode, it'll be unique spin. I hope it's a unique spin, not just here's more code, more code, more code. That's a tedious thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, the big question, of course, that's a big question here. People always keep emailing me saying, should I learn to code? Is it too late to learn to code? Am I going to be out of a job before I even finish? Do you think our days as developers are numbered? Are we going to be out of a job in like 5 years?
I don't think so, for the reason that for you to turn an idea into an app, you have to properly describe what you want the app to do. And your average non-technical person does not know how to do that yet. So it takes a lot of background information on figuring that kind of stuff out to then eventually end up making an app that does XYZ. So because of that, I think at the moment we are not currently out of a job because people cannot accurately describe what they want. Like, that's the whole point of the entire technical field, is because people can't describe what they want to make something happen. If you are completely non-technical and haven't dabbled in programming or anything, I think that that's not possible yet. It's still, I think it's the point where it will help developers and can help you learn, but it's not going to replace us at the moment just yet.
Yes. I actually cited that during my Deep Dish Swift talk in May last year, whatever it was, as a Kate Houston quote. She's, I think, director of engineering at DuckDuckGo. She said, when you can get people to agree on the problem, the solution will be obvious. And the underlying point is that no matter how optimistic you are about AI, I think everyone agrees we're a long way from AI that can make clients agree on anything. And, you know, the solution isn't necessarily the only part, the biggest part of the problem. The getting the problem defined clearly itself is the big thing. So yeah, I think you're right. I'm optimistic on the coding front. I really am. Firstly, for two reasons. Firstly, I think a whole bunch of folks just love coding. They love sitting down at Xcode and saying, what am I going to build today? This is why we all have these discarded Xcode projects, because it was so much fun to build. We don't actually want to ship them. Our goal isn't to become a millionaire for selling some random app we've made. It's just to have fun building stuff and creating stuff. In the same way, you can go to IKEA and buy a table, or you can learn woodworking and build a table. People still love building stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's not going to go away ever. I hope that hacker instinct stays with us for a long, long time yet, because it's so much fun. But equally, for the reasons I've said, I think the coding part is the least interesting part of the problem. I want folks to think about building beautiful, usable, accessible apps that solve real-world problems, and AI just doesn't do that.
Yep, I'd agree with that. This episode's open ballot question is, how do you approach debugging? So how do you figure out what is wrong with the code that you wrote? Or sometimes somebody else's code? So first off, we have Mark Pauly, who says, check assumptions. There is generally some bottleneck to check where you can say, okay, I expect to get XYZ at that point. Make sure you get XYZ. And that is in fact true at this point in time. And this is very true. And I really like starting with this point because you have to first figure out what the problem is. Because that is the first step of any debugging, is figure out what is actually happening versus what do you expect to happen. And that's like where I start for everything.
Yeah. And I think one thing I've said in the past, and I really should shout this more because I don't think enough folks get it, is when you add an assert function call to the start of every function call you make, every method you write, assert this, assert that, assert something else, it goes away at compile time. You can assert against the parameters you've been passed in, A, B, and C, is the int correct, is the array, whatever, just assertions, assertions, assertions galore, and they all get compiled out at release time. And so your assumptions, you start to program them in, make the runtime check the assumptions for you. And so rather than having to do the work yourself of, you know, putting a breakpoint in, saying what the value is, just assert, 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 assert everywhere. Sprinkle it on like cake sprinkles everywhere you want to. Assert, 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 assert. It's free and it's amazing. Make the Mac do the work for you.
Somebody needs to make that GIF of the person with the sprinkles and just have the word assert coming down of assert everywhere.
Yeah.
And Daniel Hammond says, use git bisect. So if you can reproduce the bug reliably, then you can start using git bisect and actually figure out where the bug is.
So this is one of the few like more advanced Git features I think folks need to know. There's a lot to Git. Git's just huge and complex and kind of mangy in places, kind of hard to use. But bisect can be a massive time saver. So if you aren't familiar with it, there's a fairly simple way to approach many kinds of problems called a binary chop. If I said to you, Michaela, pick a number between 0 and 100, and you pick, I don't know, 82 or something, I'd say, is it 50? Is it higher or lower? You'd say, well, it's higher. I then go, okay, halfway between 50 and 175 and say, is it 75? You say, well, it's still higher. I'd do halfway between 175. So I'm like, I don't know, 85 or 87 or something. I get closer and closer by halving each time and basically getting the correct answer in, you know, 8 moves rather than 100 moves. And Git Bisect does that for Git checkout. So it lets you roll back to a version where you know the bug was not there, like halfway back, and then it picks another version towards the middle somewhere. And okay, does it happen there? Yes. Does it happen here? No. Okay, find somewhere in the middle. Does it happen here? Yes, here, no. And eventually you find the exact place where the bug was introduced. And you can see the exact code that triggered the bug and therefore hopefully fix it. Obviously, this requires good version control hygiene. You've got to make sure you do small bug commits and so forth. Don't like change 10 things at once, otherwise it's very hard to work with. But small, regular commits mean that Git Bisect works very well.
Yeah, I haven't used this one before, but it makes sense when you're debugging something that you don't know like where in the code that this thing is happening. Because you have to pinpoint, it could be one or many things too, and that's debugging.
Yes, yeah. It's particularly good for, firstly, when a bug was introduced a while ago. Like if it was last week or yesterday, you're like, okay, I remember that code, I can just fix that. But if it was months ago and it kind of sat there bubbling under the surface for a while.
Crawling around.
You forget, you move on, you've lost the context. It's also good for what I call Smilex bugs. The very old Batman movie, I want to say 1989, Michael Keaton. Yeah, I know, exactly, before you were born. That's the Michaela before I was born. Jack Nicholson played the Joker, and in the movie, he releases Smilex into the world to kill people, and it's not inside makeup, it's not inside hairspray, it's not inside, I don't know, diaper cream, but you got to put this together with this and this, then you get it. So a simple like, oh, it's in the toothpaste, fine, toss toothpaste away, but it's not, it's got to be the toothpaste and the hairspray and the shaving cream. Then it kills you. So that's the best kind of bug for Git Bisect. When it's not a trivial little, oh, it's just that. When it's quite a nasty, gnarly kind of bug you're trying to dig around for because it's triggered by A, B, and C at the same time, Git Bisect rocks.
Oh, man, programming.
Yeah, good luck with that, ChatGPT. Git Bisect.
Stephen Batesel mentions, if it's possible, try to write a test that fails when the bug happens. So this is really good when you're into unit testing and being able to do unit testing. You can start writing tests around the actual bug and then figure out really what is going on too.
Yeah, this is the perfect interview answer. Well done, Stephen. and not being facetious for a second, if you're sitting here thinking I have very few tests in my code or maybe no tests in my code or insufficient tests in my code, actually writing a test when the bug happens is a great way to get into testing. Because now you've got a test that will say, okay, it's failed because of the bug. You fix the bug. The test now passes. And therefore, in the future, that test is still there, ensuring the bug never creeps back in again. So you've got a test. You are infinitely better tested than you were before if you had zero tests. And it's a great way to start chipping away at testability of your app while also ensuring those bugs don't come back in the future. So it's a great thing to do all around.
Yeah, that's a really good way because I haven't done this. But what I do like about the idea of unit testing is the fact that, yeah, you write a unit test around some kind of bug. And then if you continually test your code, you can always ensure that it never comes back, which that is my favorite part of unit testing. Dan O'Leary mentions that he recently learned that changing the simulator scheme from debug to release mode can make a difference. He didn't even know that this existed until he found some kind of Swift data bug that reared its ugly head only in release mode, but it ran fine in debug.
Yeah, so this one really surprised me, actually. The concept, conceptually, yes, there are definitely all sorts of bugs that can exist in release mode that aren't in debug mode. If you have optimizations by a compiler that do things you weren't expecting. If you'd written some particularly creative, maybe not Swift, but C code or C++ code. If you've had hashif debug to enable or disable things by accident, you've introduced a bug yourself. You might have a speed issue, a timing issue, like a race condition. Your code was running fairly slowly in debug mode for various debugging reasons, but in release mode it's much faster and therefore it hits a bug. So there are definitely reasons why it happens. It can happen. I'm just amazed it happened in Swift data. That's an area I really would have thought Apple would have tested to heck. But You know, and look, to be fair, I'm not entirely sure I trust Dan anymore because he's a pilot. And I messaged him on Twitter recently because someone posted an important fact, which I learned about, massive tangent here, which is that when you're on your airplane somewhere, flying somewhere, and your plane's running late, they'll say something like, you know, we'll try and make up some time in the air. And the post is saying, that's a complete lie. There is no way, unless you get a massive magical rerouting to be a shorter route, there's no way you can make up time in the air. Best you can do is a few minutes here and there because there's a wind change or something. And the only real thing that actually changes the performance of your flight times is if you're lucky, the landing gate and there's a crew there straight away to get you off the plane. That was it. I've been lied to by people like Dan. Durr.
Thomas Radmaker, Shane Mack, Sean Allen, they all agree the best place to start is with print statements everywhere. And this is probably my go-to with debugging is using print statements and breakpoints.
And why not? It's the first thing you learn when you're doing Swift development, you're learning print, and it works. It's basically writing out assertions for you to check rather than for the runtime to check. So it's not ideal, but I mean, it's definitely easy to do. And I'm more curious what people put in the print statements. I normally go something like, here too, what to, WTF, whatever, you know? I put increasingly sweary things like my print statements down the line, because what's going on? And after a few of them, I'm like, what's going on? I give up. So print XXXXX, I give up, or something like that usually happens eventually.
I typically put emojis in a lot of my print statements. So I'll put an emoji of like something, you know, like, this is good if this happens, this is bad if this happens, like the boom emoji. Like, I now know the actual names of the emojis because I use them so often. And that's how you can like find them. But I typically put, emojis in all my print statements. So it's like, oh, if I see this emoji, then that means it's not good. So then it's easier to be like, oh, this is happening. That definitely was not supposed to happen. And then you can find out sort of, like, you can then also filter the console by the emoji, too. So then you can, like, find things. Okay.
Yeah, I like that. So you can filter by mood almost. That's one of those, like, tell me you're a Swift developer without telling me you're a Swift developer kind of problem. Because having done C++, Python, whatever in the past, PHP, relying on emojis to print properly is something I would never do because they just handle them so badly. They mash them up and who knows what comes out. Whereas in Swift, obviously, it works first time.
It's great. Jeremiah says, this is the right answer, right? And he put a link to the Sharpshooter GitHub repo by a guy named Paul Hudson.
Yeah, I had forgotten all about this repository. Sharpshooter. get up on GitHub. It's been a long time since I worked in this thing. The idea was to solve debugging problems for folks who use print debugging. And the name comes from a joke about, it's actually a logical fallacy, the Texan sharpshooter fallacy, who fires gunshots at the door of a barn, then draws a target around the biggest cluster of hits and claims to be a sharpshooter. Like just that, clearly I'm excellent after they're fired. That's what I was aiming for kind of thing. And what it does is Xcode source editor extension. It reads in your source code, finds the method place is happening. So all functions inside a class, for example, whatever. And it adds entering the method and then exiting the method, I think, as well, if I remember correctly. And it tells you, so you can basically press go, it has log lines for you, press play and it'll say entering, crash. Oh, that's the exact flow of how I got to that point, you see. Tells you how you got to the crashing area by telling you the functions that were called along the way. And it removes them all afterwards. You can just press add all and remove all and they all appear or all disappear at the same time. And so if you are using print debugging primarily, you would enjoy Sharpshooter. I'll put a link in the show notes, perhaps.
That sounds nice to use, because that's what you end up writing when you write print statements half the time, is like, this function started, this function ended. So that's super useful.
Yeah, and I think really I should extend it to do support for parameters too, so they automatically print out all the parameters being passed into each function. But this was like 7 years ago. Crikey.
That means it's on GitHub though, so if anybody wants to jump into some open source development, you can contribute to Sharpshooter.
Yeah, do it.
And also, Taylor Simpson and Mike Sachs start out with the same points of breakpoints and printing in the debugger, too. So you make a breakpoint and then print something based on wherever you have set your breakpoint to, which I find this super useful as well, because I really like how you can just set the breakpoint. You don't have to rerun your code. So rather than rewriting whatever you want to print, you just set the breakpoint where you know something may be happening and kind of going from there.
It is interesting that in the Objective-C days, this approach worked better. But gosh, so many times I've done a breakpoint. I've gone to the LDB area and typed, you know, PO something. And it's gone, nope, I can't see that variable. I'm like, what? It's right there. It's declared the line before. Why can't you see it? Like, nope, does not exist. La 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 la. I can't hear you. You know, that's what it does. And it's like the Swift's 9 years old now. It's next year is the 10th anniversary of public release of Swift. And PO and P and EXPR or whatever are still fairly broken a lot of the time. I don't understand why. And so I wonder if that's one of the reasons why print is still so popular in Swift. Making resurgence, perhaps.
Yeah, it's got to be because, yeah, it's. I like this method when it works, but it doesn't always work, and that's the frustrating part.
Yeah, hence print.
Sam McGarry also mentions, I usually use instruments when debugging performance, so the Swift UI tool can give a clear picture of what views are updating more than expected. What Swift UI tool?
That's really good.
Wait, what tool is that?
It's called Swift UI in instruments.
What?
You're learning so much in this podcast. I love it. Yeah, you're learning so much.
Wait, what is this? I was just thinking of instruments, but wait, what is the Swift UI tool?
We need to get Sam on the chat for next time. He can walk you through it. It's an instrument directly in there. I think it's actually literally just called Swift UI, the little Swift UI logo on it. And it tells you how many views the reinvoking's happening. So you can see what's actually happening behind the scenes with Swift UI and its read draws and stuff. It's nice.
Ooh, well, I have also figured out a way to do this with print. So
when print is your only hammer, everything looks like a yes. It's interesting. So I'm not going to say the name because they haven't actually announced it yet. But someone in the community is working very hard on producing a lot of instruments tutorial material, and I'm really keen to see it come out because it is a massively undervalued tool. It can tell you all sorts of detailed information about individual tasks, launching, interrupting, pausing, CPU time, thread time. It's really powerful, but bafflingly hard to use at times. And so anything to try to sweep away the confusion, tell more folks the greatness of things like the Swift UI tool will be very welcome indeed, I think.
Yeah, and that I think is super useful because when you're first beginning, your first step is, can you write code? The next step is, okay, can you write it better? And can you write it faster?
Yes, the Kent Beck quote, make it work, make it right, make it fast. And this time to end on, I want to bring in one thing that has stuck in my brain now for a few years. Really, one of the things that really truly changed the way I think about coding. It's from my friend Rob Napier, who's incredible engineer, full stop anyway. There's lots of things he said that really stick in my head. This is one of them. He wrote, here's a periodic reminder for you. When debugging, you must first accept that something you believe is true is not true. Because if everything you believed about your system were true, it would work. It doesn't, so you're wrong about something. And with that grim truth still settling its way into your brain, we come to the end of the episode. Thank you so much for tuning in again, folks. Next time, our open ballot's going to be, where do you find app inspiration? Remember, tell your friends, subscribe, leave reviews you can do. Take care, folks. Till next time. Bye.
See ya.